to have looked at me. I gave him an explanation. I told him some of the things that had been happening to Miranda since Century Records became interested in her. I told him I'd been hired to find out what I could, and that as far as I knew, Brent Daniels would have had absolutely no reason to be in the line of fire. I gave the detective my name and number and address and said sure, I'd be happy to talk more. But right now, I said, I'm getting Miranda out of here. The detective looked at Miranda, then looked at me. His eyes softened just a little. He said, all right.
This is her home, Willis growled.
I found myself stepping toward the old man, grabbing the tip of the cane that he'd raised toward me. The tension along the shaft of wood was uneven, his grip on the other end weak. With not much force, I could have taken it away, or thrust it back, anything I wanted.
Trace, Miranda said.
Her fingers dug into my shoulders with a surprising amount of force. I pushed the tip of the cane away, lightly. Call me whenever, I told the detective. The detective was reappraising me moment by moment, like I was a tie game in progress, sudden death overtime. I'll do that, he promised. Miranda's fingers relaxed. As I walked back down the steps holding Miranda's hand, Milo Chavez was arguing with one of the newspaper reporters, something about family privacy. I couldn't tell if he was arguing for or against. Deputy Frank was still looking at me, giving me white noise with his eyes. Jay Griffin, the ME, had lifted something long and black and thin from the ashes of the tractor shed and was turning it. In the spotlights, the forearm looked surreal, like a piece of black glazed ceramic, nothing that could ever have been part of a human body. Chapter 49. The next morning, vendors were selling offerings for the dead all along General McMullen Road. The parking lot of the Orange Stucco Strip Mall was lined with battered pickup trucks and delivery vans, all covered with wreaths, crosses made of blue silk flowers, pictures of Jesus, flowery frames empty and ready for the insertion of the beloved's pictures. There were tables of foodstuffs. Pan Muerte, the bread of the dead, fresh tamales, tortillas, black cat and pumpkin and skull-shaped cookies. Dia de los Muertos was tomorrow. Today, All Souls' Day was just a warm-up. Otherwise, we would never have been able to turn into San Fernando Cemetery without getting choked in traffic. The circular maze of one-way drives wasn't empty by a long shot, though. In every section of the cemetery, people were unloading the trunks of their cars, coffee cans of marigolds, picnic baskets, all the things their antepasados would need. Old men with trowels were cutting weeds away from the marble plaques or digging holes for new plants. About half the graves had already been adorned, several buried so thick in flowers they looked like a florist's waste dump. The less conventional graves had fake cobwebs covering them, flowers planted in jack-o'-lanterns, little cloth ghosts dangling from strings on the tombstones. Others were fluttering with ribbons and spinning sunflower and flamingo-shaped pinwheels.
Good Lord, Miranda said.
She was dressed in jeans and her boots and an oversized UC Berkeley t-shirt she'd borrowed from my closet. Her hair was pulled back in a clasp. Her face, clean scrubbed and devoid of makeup, looked pale and younger. She wasn't back to normal by a long shot. About every hour her hands would start trembling again, or she'd suddenly start crying. But there were pauses when she seemed surprisingly stable. She'd even given me a weak smile when I'd brought her huevos rancheros for breakfast in futon. Or maybe what made her smile was the way I looked in the morning after sleeping on the floor with a cat all night. She wouldn't tell me. We drove around a huge mound of rocks, topped with a life-sized stone crucifix. At the base of Jesus' feet, a brown mutt dog was taking a nap. We kept driving toward the back of the cemetery, then circled around. I was looking for a maroon Cadillac. I finally found it in the center of the cemetery. Ralph Arguello, was about 20 yards from the curb, standing over his mother, a large woman in a brown sack dress who was kneeling at one of the graves planting marigolds. Ralph was easy to spot. He was dressed in his outfit of choice, oversized guayabera shirt, jeans, black boots. His black ponytail looked freshly braided. The butt of his .357 had snagged on the edge of the olive shirt, making it anything but concealed. He was holding a bunch of silver Mylar balloons decorated with pictures of trains and cars. I parked behind the Cadillac. Miranda followed my stare.
That's your friend?
Come on. We walked between grave markers, most of them flat plaques, mirrored gray granite that reflected the sky perfectly. The mottos on the tombstones were trilingual, Latin and Spanish and English. The decorations were something totally different, somewhere between ancient Aztec and modern Walmart. Ralph turned toward us as we walked up. His thick round glasses looked cut from the same material as the Mylar balloons and the tombstones. It was difficult to tell whether he looked at Miranda or not.
Vato, he said.
I nodded. We waited for a while, not saying anything else, while Mama Arguello completed saying the rosary over the grave. At first I didn't realize where we were, what part of the cemetery. Then I noticed how close together the grave markers were, that each space was no more than 2 feet wide. They went on like that, row after row, for what looked like a good half acre. Nearby was another marble Jesus, this one surrounded by kids, the Spanish inscription, Suffer the Children. The decorations around us were sprinkled with Halloween candy, toys, flower arrangements, shaped like lambs. Mama Arguello finished her prayers, and then took the cluster of balloons from Ralph and tied it on a stake in the grass. The engraving on the marker said, Jose Domingo Arguello, born August 8, 1960, died August 8, 1960. In recuerdo. The hook on the stake had frayed knots from past years of balloons, all baby blue ribbons, some perhaps decades old. Mama Arguello smiled and gave me a hug. She smelled of marigolds, a pungent scent like perfume from a jewelry box buried for 100 years. Then Mama Arguello hugged Miranda, telling her in Spanish that she was glad we could come. It didn't really matter that Mama Arguello didn't know Miranda. Mama A had stopped caring about things like that about the time she stopped being able to see. Her glasses, Ralph assured me, were just for show. With or without them, the world for Mama had long ago become a series of blurry spots and lights. It was now mostly about smells and sounds.
Come with me, she told Miranda.
She dug her pudgy brown fingers into Miranda's forearm.
I have some tea.
Miranda looked uncertainly back at me, then at Ralph. Ralph's grin couldn't have made her feel any easier. The old woman led her back to the Cadillac, where she started unloading things into Miranda's arms, a thermos, a picnic basket, 2 pots of flowers, a large wreath. Ralph made a small laugh. When he looked down at the tomb marker, his smile didn't waver at all.
My older brother, Ralph told me.
I nodded. Jose Domingo, an old man's name. I wondered how many hours Jose had lived, what he thought up there in heaven of the 30-plus years of infants' gifts and balloons he'd been receiving at his gravesite. You got more family here? I asked Ralph. Ralph waved his hand toward the east like it was his real estate.
Take us 2 days, me and Mama. Start here and work our way around. Yvette's right over there. We have lunch with her, man.
Yvette, Kelly Arguello's mother. I exchanged looks with Ralph, but he didn't have to tell me about Kelly not being here, or about what he thought of her defection. He watched Miranda struggling with the ofrendas Mama Arguello kept handing her. Mama was giving her directions in Spanish, telling Miranda stories she couldn't understand. Miranda began smiling. At first it was strained, grieved. Then Mama told her about who a particular bottle of whiskey was for, a real cabron, and Miranda laughed despite herself, almost spilling a plate of cookies balanced in the crook of her arm.
The chica's in trouble? Ralph asked.
I don't know. I think she might be. I told him what had been happening. Ralph shook his head.
Pinche rednecks, pinche Chavez. You don't see him out here today.
Can you help, Ralphus? Ralph looked at his brother's tombstone, then reached down and yanked out a piece of crabgrass at the edge of the marble. He threw it behind him carelessly. The weed landed on one of the unadorned graves behind him.
This lady means something to you?
I hesitated, tried to form an answer, but Ralph held up his hand.
Forget I ask, Vato. How long I known you, eh?
From another person, it would have irritated me. From Ralph, the statement was so honest, the grin that went with it so blatantly amused, that I couldn't help but crack a smile. A long time.
Shit, yes.
Miranda came back, burdened down with gifts for the dead, but more at ease now, smiling tentatively. She followed Mama Arguello as she led the way to the next ancestor. Miranda looked back at me and asked,
Coming?
We went to visit Yvette about half an acre away. Her tombstone was an upright piece of white marble, rough finished around the edges. The stone was almost engulfed in a large pyracantha bush that hung its branches down in the shape of an octopus. Each branch was thick with red berries the size of birdshot. Across the drive from her grave, a new hole was being dug. The riderless backhoe had scooped out a perfect coffin-sized trench in the lawn and was now standing there abandoned. I stared at the backhoe. Miranda helped Mama Arguello spread a blanket next to the grave and set out some paper plates of cinnamon toast and cups of steaming tea that smelled like lemon. The cold air swept the steam from the tea. Mama set out a plate and a cup for Yvette's grave, then began telling the tombstone how well Kelly was doing in college. Ralph listened without comment. Miranda was shaking her head, looking across the cemetery at similar scenes here and there, at different grave sites. There were tears on her cheeks again.
Today is better, Ralph told her. Tomorrow, loco. Worse than fiesta.
Miranda brushed her hand under her eye, dazed.
I've lived in San Antonio my whole life. I never...
She shook her head. Ralph nodded.
Which San Antonio, eh?
A few feet away, a family unloaded from a long black town car. The grandmother had wraparound sunglasses and walked stiffly, like this was her first time out of the nursing home in a long time. She was escorted by a woman with orange and brown streaked hair and a pink sweatsuit and lots of jewelry. A couple of teenage girls followed, each with an expensive warm-up suit and a smaller version of Mom's hairdo and jewelry ensemble. They walked to a grave where the colors were white and green, the wreath a flowery Oakland A's logo. On the tombstone was a flower-framed picture, a teenage boy in an open coffin, his face the same color as the white satin, his A's jersey on, his hair combed, and his pencil mustache trimmed and a look of pride sculpted on his dead face. Gangbanger, maybe 15. Ralph has a rental house nearby, I said. I've used it before. Miranda looked beyond the cemetery into the surrounding neighborhood of run-down stores and multicolored one-room houses. The tears were still coming.
Is it safe?
Ralph started laughing quietly.
Nobody you know would ever look here, I said. That's the whole point. You stay with Ralph, you'll be safe.
Miranda thought about that, then looked at Mama Arguello, who was offering her some lemon tea.
All right, Miranda said.
And then, like her timer had run out, she curled her head against her knees and shivered. Mama Arguello smiled, not at all like she knew what we were talking about. Then she told Yvette's tombstone how nice it was to have visitors, how fresh the pan muerte tasted this year. Chapter 50. When I got back to 90 Queen Anne, a gold foil package the size of two glass bricks was sitting on the porch. The card said, "This will look perfect on your desk at UTSA. Good luck today. Happy birthday." Mother's writing. She made no mention of my failure to come to her Halloween / by the way, it's Trace's birthday party the night before. Inside the wrapping was the Riverside Chaucer, new edition, a $75 book. I took it inside. I stared at some tentative notes I'd made two mornings ago for the demo class I was about to do. After last night, the whole idea seemed absurd, trivial, and oddly comforting. Students were going to attend classes today. Assistant professors were going to yawn and drink coffee and stumble through boring routines, and most of them wouldn't even smell like house fires. They wouldn't see blackened bones every time they closed their eyes. They wouldn't catch themselves humming songs by the recently murdered. With a kind of dread, I realized I wanted the class to go well. Robert Johnson was, of course, sleeping on the outfit I needed to wear, so I did the tablecloth trick. Robert Johnson flipped, got to his feet, and glared at me. It took me 5 minutes and a full roll of scotch tape to remove the black hair from the white shirt. 5 more minutes to tie the tie with Robert Johnson helping. After that, it's a blur. The demo lesson did go well, I guess. I chose Complaint to His Purse and did the most radical things I could remember from graduate seminars. Break the class into small groups. Ask them to read the poem aloud while holding their wallets. Ask them to write a modern-day interpretation. We had a few laughs comparing Chaucer to a phone solicitor, then trying to find a Middle English phrase that was the equivalent of suck-up. Most of the students didn't even fall asleep. Despite my dress clothes, I probably looked like I'd slept on the floor the night before and spent my morning in a cemetery, but that was okay. Most of the students looked that way, too. Professor Mitchell shook my hand a lot in the hallway afterward and told me how he was sure I'd get the job. The other professors filed out without saying anything. They frowned just as much as they did during my earlier interview. Maybe tracing the etymology of suck-up had been too much. I drove out of the UTSA visitor parking lot feeling tingly and hollow. I was halfway down I-10, doing an impossible 70 miles per hour before I even realized I had gotten on the highway. I took the first exit, pulled the VW into a strip mall parking lot, and shut the ignition. I tried to get my heartbeat under control. I didn't have much luck. I couldn't place the feeling right away, sort of like an electric generator spinning in my intestines. Not going anywhere, not hooked to anything. Just making useless electricity. It was a few more minutes before I recognized it as shock. I'd felt this way a year ago after I'd killed a man. I'd woken up a few nights afterward with the same feeling, disconnected inside, like someone else had just vacated my body and left me the shell. I told myself this was only a college lesson, for God's sake. I started the car again. I decided to take comfort in the mundane and drove next door to Taco Cabana for enchiladas to go. When I got back to 90 Queen Anne, my favorite car was parked conspicuously across the street. Deputy Frank had the window down on his black Ford Festiva and was rubbing a finger along the top of his mustache while he read a magazine. He might have been a little more obvious if he put wavy hands on his windshield wipers, but only slightly. I parked the VW and walked across to his car. Frank pretended to ignore me. In his passenger seat was your normal stakeout gear, junk food, a camera, bottled water, a tape recorder, and shotgun mic. He had a suit jacket off, so the shoulder holster was in plain view. There was a black briefcase between Frank's knees. He flipped a page of Today's Parent. "Colic," he said, like he was talking to himself. "It's driving me crazy." "That's rough," I agreed. I waited. Frank turned a couple more pages. He read like he was looking at assembly instructions, his eyes flicking back and forth around the pages in no particular order, looking for the schematics on proper baby building. "You supposed to be keeping tabs on me?" I asked. Frank nodded, tapping his thumb on a picture of a new superabsorbent diaper. "Sheckley?" Frank nodded again. "You want to come in for some enchiladas?" Three times was a charm. Frank put down his magazine, picked up his briefcase, and got out of the car. We walked around the side of the house. My landlord, Gary Hales, was standing in his living room watching out the window as I brought the man with the shoulder-holstered gun and the black briefcase onto his property. Gary loves it when I do stuff like that. I opened the door of the in-law, and Robert Johnson padded up, bumped into Frank's leg, then stepped back indignantly, his super-keen animal senses suddenly warning him that I wasn't alone. "Hey, Blackie." Frank bent down and scratched Robert Johnson's ear. Frank apparently passed inspection. Robert Johnson began rubbing the side of his face vigorously on Frank's shoe. Frank glanced around the room, still in read schematic mode, until his eyes came to rest on the exhibition sword in the wall mount. "Taiji?" I nodded, surprised. Nobody guesses correctly. Frank waved at the futon. "Okay. Sure," I said. He sat, putting his briefcase on the coffee table. I went into the kitchen and took out the two foam boxes of enchilada dinners. Robert Johnson materialized on the counter instantly. I got out three paper plates and wicker plate holders. Two enchiladas for me, one for Frank, one for Robert Johnson. Flour tortillas and beans and rice and grease all around. I took the food into the main room, set Robert Johnson's on the rug, and handed Frank his. Frank sat forward on the futon. He rolled a tortilla into a tube, dipped it in enchilada sauce, and bit the end off.
"Enough's enough," he said. "The briefcase has some prelims from the ME on Brent Daniels, some paperwork I borrowed from Hollywood Park on Alex Blanc Eagle. There's also some other cases from the Avalon Department where..." He stopped, considering. "Where Sheckley's name has figured prominently."
"And you're showing all this to me?" Frank read the wall. He chewed his tortilla.
"Some guys I know at Bexar County. Larry Drapuski, Shell Masters. They tell me you're solid."
I tried not to look surprised. Larry and Shell didn't always tell me I was solid. The adjectives they used about me much more frequently had to do with gas or liquid. Frank must have caught them at a weak moment.
"You should be giving this to Samuel Barrera," I suggested.
Frank gave me a brief smile, then he slid the briefcase toward me across the table. "But Barrera would feel obliged to say where he got the information," I continued. "You need someone who can take a little heat off you." He finished his tortilla, wiped his fingers, then stood up.
"Shame you didn't come home today," he speculated. "I'll wait until midnight, then decide to call it quits."
"Agreed." I nodded.
"Good luck with the colic."
Frank actually smiled.
"Yeah. And Navarre. I hear things at the department. Elgin, some of the other guys who were at Fleur's last night. They're hoping you come back into Avalon County sometime when they're on duty. If I were you, I wouldn't do it."
When Frank was gone, I kicked off my Justins and let my toes expand to their normal size. Robert Johnson came over and discovered that his head fit perfectly in a size 11 boot. He shimmied in up to his waist and stayed that way, his tail flicking back and forth.
"You're weird," I told him.
His back legs padded a few times. The tail flicked. Then I remembered I wasn't supposed to be home. That left several options, none of them pleasant. I reclaimed my boots and headed out toward Monta Vista. Chapter 51. When I got to the St. Pierre's house, the realtor was just leaving.
Mr. St. Pierre? She asked.
Her tone was mildly amused. She held the front door open for me with just her fingertips, up at ear level, the way my mom used to hold up my dirty T-shirts, asking if I could get them in the hamper for once.
Thanks, I said.
I made some sketches.
She wedged her clipboard snugly under the arm of her rotten apple-brown blazer.
The house has marvelous flow patterns.
I've always thought so. She nodded, pursed her lips, then appraised the front of the house one more time.
Well, I'll get back to you.
Allison gave you a time frame?
She said immediately.
Perfect. She gave me another amused smile, probably never met a talent agent before, then offered me her business card. Sheila Fletcher and Associates. The ink was the same color brown as her jacket and her nails. She waved three fingers at me as she walked down the driveway and got into her Jeep. Sure enough, the interior of the house had great flow patterns now. Easy when there was nothing to flow around. The white sofas and the artwork pedestals were gone. The Oaxacan wall hangings had been removed so the walls were all white paint and windows. 6 million moving boxes were stacked by the door. The bar was still set up, however, and there were two glasses on it, one sticky with lipstick and bourbon residue, the other half full of tepid water. The fireplace had been used the night before. The smell of smoke lingered from the poorly working flue. After the previous night, smoke was not a smell I was glad to encounter. I went upstairs and started checking the bedrooms. The first was packed. In Les's room, the four-poster bed was stripped, the roll-top desk taped shut, his closet empty. I opened one of the moving boxes packed in the corner. Les's Denton High School yearbook was on top.
What the hell are you doing?
I turned and found Allison was in the doorway. She raked her blonde hair into stiff, wet rows, rinsed but not shampooed. Her complexion was pasty, the corners of her eyes unhealthy red. Her figure was totally hidden under a man's white dress shirt and baggy khakis. Maybe they were Les's. The shirt was speckled with some light brown liquid. Glad I caught you before you left town, I said. She glared at me.
Get the hell out, Trace! Isn't it enough?
She faltered. She waved her hand vaguely north in the direction of the Daniels' ranch. I nudged the moving box with my foot. The realtor says you're moving out immediately.
Is that any of your business?
Possibly. She grabbed her forearm with her opposite hand like she was covering a wound. She looked past my shoulder.
I'm renting the house, all right? I can cover the mortgage that way until the sale can happen. It's about the only choice I had.
What happened to taking over the agency? Allison laughed. Her voice was suddenly quivery.
Milo's been real busy with Miranda, but not too busy to bring in some lawyers. Why don't you ask him?
She stepped inside and sank down on the edge of the stripped mattress. She stared at the boxes of Les's things. Who did you have over last night, Allison?
That is definitely none of your business.
You're going to need an alibi. She opened her mouth. She searched for something to say, but couldn't quite find it. Arson with murder is almost always to cover traces, I said. Homicide done hastily by somebody who flew off the handle. Who does that sound like? She made a small croaking sound.
You think?
I don't think, I said, but it doesn't look good. You packing up and moving out? If I was the detective in charge of Brent's murder, maybe with Tilden Sheckley paying me to find a convenient solution, I'd start with you. Your husband disappears, your lover gets torched, you've got a history of violent, unpredictable behavior. I doubt many people would come to your defense. She hugged her arms.
I've got nothing. Brent is dead, Les is gone, Milo's got the agency, and I've got nothing. Just leave me alone, okay?
She leaned forward until her face was almost over her knees. I counted to 10. It didn't help.
Get up. My own voice sounded strange. Come on. I grabbed Allison's upper arms and lifted her to her feet. She was heavy, not dead weight, but her bones seemed to be lead. I had to use most of my strength to keep her from twisting out of my grip. Finally, she succeeded and pulled away. She stood there, wet-eyed, rubbing the white stripes on her arms where my fingers had been.
You fucker!
I don't appreciate the self-pity. It's not going to get us anywhere.
Just get out, Trace, you hear me? I used to think you were all right.
She glared at me, willing me away, but the anger was unsustainable. She took a long, shaky breath and looked around at the boxes again, the roll-top desk, the blank walls. Finally, she sank back down onto the bed.
I'm so tired, she murmured. Just go away.
Let's get you out of here. Let's do something constructive. She shook her head apathetically. When I sat next to her, Allison leaned against me. Nothing personal, just like I was a new wall.
I'm moving home to goddamn Falfurious, she said. Can you believe that? This house can buy me about 6 of the nicest houses down there. I can raise cows, listen to crickets at night. Isn't that insane?
She looked up at me. Her eyes were watery. I'm the wrong person to ask. She laughed the word shit.
You never give me a goddamn straight answer, do you? Where's Miranda?
Staying safe.
In your apartment, sharing that little futon?
No, not with me. Allison looked at me, uncertainly. She heard the finality and the edge of bitterness in my voice, and she didn't know quite what to do with it. She started to get up, but I held her shoulder, not forcefully.
I'd like to say that from there events took their own course and I was caught by surprise, but they didn't, and I wasn't.
I kissed her. For once, Allison St. Pierre didn't put up a fight. She eased into the kiss with a kind of exhausted relief. After a long time, she leaned back into the bed, and I went with her. She bit and kissed and breathed in my ear as I tried futilely to work the first button on the massive white dress shirt until she laughed and whispered,
"Forget it."
She sat up just enough to get the shirt off overhead. Then she pressed against me again and felt twice as warm, almost feverish. Her back was all goosebumps. We rolled around on Les St. Pierre's bed, and with each new angle, the most exposed piece of clothing was kicked or pulled or cursed away. I think Allison stopped crying by the time the clothes were all gone. Her skin was uncomfortably hot, except for her fingers. Those were ice cold. There was some unstated agreement that this lovemaking would require non-stop movement, not necessarily frenzied, but definitely continuous. Stopping would lead to thinking, and thinking would be bad. We took turns, crushing each other into the slick, uncomfortably bumpy surface of the mattress. Little pinprickers of rayon stitching needling us in our backs. The room was air-conditioned, but we quickly became sweaty and noisy until the sounds became an uncontrollable cause for the giggles, and then almost as quickly stopped mattering. We rolled a little too far off the side of the bed. I remember something about a pain in my elbow, but that didn't matter much either. We readjusted and sat facing one another, Allison's chin at the level of my mouth and her feet curled against the small of my back. Allison hugged me very tight with her arms and legs and buried her face in my neck and trembled quietly, as if she were crying again. I inhaled sharply and joined her, and my body didn't know to stop the movement until Allison's muffled voice spoke into my neck.
Please. Okay. Okay.
We stayed still then, feeling each other breathe until the rhythm of our lungs slowed and the hardwood floor began to feel uncomfortable. Our skin separated in places like candle wax being peeled away. Allison smushed her nose against my cheek and rubbed around until her lips connected with mine. When I kissed her the second time, I kissed teeth.
When you say let's do something constructive, Mr. Navarre...
Shut up. She laughed, pulled her face away and cupped my ears lightly with her fingers.
Didn't happen.
Of course not. She kissed me again.
You're still holding out on me for $50,000.
You're just trying to get the money. We showed each other how much we detested each other for a while longer. At some point, I remember looking up and seeing the Latina maid in the doorway. But when I opened my eyes for a better look, she was gone. Just a momentary vision of bored, aging eyes in an impassive face, showing more irritation than embarrassment at the gringos on the floor of the stripped bedroom, giggling foolishly, and muttered little, I hate yous. Maybe to the maid we were just one more item she would be glad to be rid of when the house passed to more respectable owners.
Chapter 52.
I like the Audi better, Allison told me. We were sitting in the VW with the top up, the windows open, but not a bit of circulation coming through. The afternoon had turned thick and gray and lukewarm. Nothing interesting was happening at the warehouse across the street.
What is this? I asked. Number 7?
5, she corrected, pushing up the sunglasses. It just feels like 7.
I borrowed the list of addresses from her, a photocopy of the document we'd found in Les St. Pierre's boat shed. I scanned the page. A total of 23 addresses just in San Antonio. At this rate, it would be way past Friday before I even had time to find them all, much less figure out ways to get inside and see if they had value to the case against Sheckley. Sam Barrera could have probably put his agency into high gear and gotten the job done in one afternoon if he hadn't had legal restrictions to deal with. Sam Barrera could go to hell. So far, all the addresses were storage facilities or trucking yards. Not all of them said Paintbrush Enterprises on the gates, but I had a suspicion Tilden Sheckley or his friends from Luxembourg had a stake in each, one way or another. Each address had a date next to it. Allison and I had started the search with the location closest to today and worked our way forward in time. We were now on November 5th, 4 days from now. The address was in a light industry park in the elbow of land where Nacogdoches met Perrin Beidel and became, in true Texas creative thinking, Naco Perrin. The storage facility consisted of a pair of long parallel buildings painted army green with mauve trim. The inward-facing walls were lined with steel roll-up doors and stubby loading docks and were just far enough apart that a semi-rig could back in and deposit its freight box on either side. The asphalt between the two buildings was scarred with large black semicircles from truck tires. It looked like somebody had been in the habit of drinking from God-sized Coke cans there and hadn't had the sense to use coasters. The complex was ringed with 10-foot chain link, no barbed wire at the top, but a security guard in a booth at the front gate, and good night lighting all the way around. In the day, traffic on the backside of the industry park was heavy, a constant stream of cars cruising Naco Perrin's ugly strip malls and fast food restaurants. On the entrance side of Sheckley's facility, traffic was lighter. The only neighbor was a sulfur processing plant across the street, acres of weed and mountains of moon dust. At the moment, the guard at the gate wasn't very interesting to watch. He was reading a little magazine, Security Guard's Digest, probably. The gates were closed, and there were two detached freight boxes in the yard, in front of closed loading doors. No business, in or out. Allison sighed.
This is better than staring at the walls at the old house, but only slightly.
Before we'd left Monte Vista, Allison had started referring to her home of 2 years as the old house. When she'd plopped into the shotgun seat of the VW, she'd insisted that she was completely all right, over less, finished grieving for Brent, ready to help me, and convinced that our afternoon together had been nothing but a nice little break from reality. I wasn't buying any of it, and I don't think she was either. But it did let us set aside weightier issues so we could concentrate on watching empty loading docks. I was about to suggest trying address number 6
when a white BMW sedan cruised past us on Nacogdoches. It slowed, then turned at the gate. The security guard immediately discarded his magazine and came out to the driver's side window. "Ignition," I said. Allison sat up and looked. Jean Kraus rolled down the BMW's window and spoke to the guard, who nodded. Jean spoke again, smiling, and the guard nodded even more vigorously. The guard trotted up to the gate, unchained it, and swung open one side. The white BMW drove through. Jean Kraus parked next to the first trailer, and he and two other men extracted themselves from the sedan. Jean was dressed for success, an Armani suit, beige, with a little black tie and plenty of silver accents. The other two men I didn't recognize. One was well-built, Anglo, with curly brown hair and dress slacks that didn't match the sleeveless T-shirt. The third guy was taller, older, a black sweatsuit and the remnants of black hair. John seemed to be pointing out some things to the men, giving them the tour. After a 5-minute conversation and some head nodding and a few looks at the loading bays, all three got back in the BMW and left. "They're moving cargo out," I said, "getting rid of it early." Allison looked at me. "Are we being constructive yet?" "We are on the outskirts." I started the engine of the VW. We followed Jean's BMW for a few miles, down Perrenbeidel, before it became too difficult. The traffic was bad. Jean was a little too jumpy a driver, and my orange bug was anything but nondescript. To stay with him, I had to risk discovery. I fell back and let him go. "Does this mean we don't get to beat the shit out of anybody?" Allison wanted to know. "I'm sorry, honey." Allison pouted. It was starting to get dark when I dropped her back at the old house in Monte Vista. Allison insisted on staying there, and she insisted on staying there alone. I didn't argue very hard with the second part. Seeing her get out of the car, I started developing a funny empty feeling in my intestinal basement that either meant I very much wanted to stay with her or I very much didn't. You get to feeling those extremes and not being able to tell them apart, it's time to go home by yourself and feed the cat. I watched her walk all the way up the sidewalk and go inside, and I watched the door for a long time after that. The door didn't reopen. When I got home, I showered, picked the cleanest things I could find out of the growing pile of laundry, then made two calls. Ray Lozano answered at the Bexar County ME's office. "Raymond, this is Trace." A moment of silence. "As in the guy who owes me the Spurs tickets?" "Yeah, about that. Save it, Navarre. You keep making promises, and I keep believing it'll just make me feel bad." "Faith is an admirable quality, Raymond. You like the Oilers? What do you want?" I read Lozano the notes Frank had given me from the Avalon County autopsy of Brent Daniels. "So," he said, "what can you interpret?" "They were lucky to get as much tissue as they did, given the state of the body. Sounds like this guy was dead before he burned." "No soot particles in the bronchi. No carboxyhemoglobin in the fluids. This guy didn't go down breathing smoke." "And the lack of a positive ID?" "Somewhat unusual, given that they know the victim, but it's early. They have to be 100% sure. If you have to wait for X-ray records from a big hospital or wait for the odontologist, maybe the anthropologist, to come down from Austin, it can take up to 10 days, sometimes more." "It doesn't sound like there's really any doubt, though. The size is right, compensating for shrinkage. Age and sex are right." "What about these trace chemicals?" I read off some hard-to-pronounce compounds the ME had found in the few remaining fluids of Brent's body. Lozano ticked his tongue a few times. "I'd have to check with the toxicologist. Was this guy an alcoholic?" "Probably, yes." "Okay, that gives you a setup for liver damage, poor sugar processing. If the guy came in contact with certain other drugs in a large enough dosage, they could trigger the kind of chemicals you're seeing there. Only that would mean the subject was in a diabetic coma before he died." "A coma? You mean like if he came into contact with diabetes drugs, glucose something or other?" "Glucophage, absolutely." I was quiet so long, Lozano finally said, "You still there?" "Yeah. You think..."
Would somebody OD on these for suicide? Lozano blew air. Not unless they were mainline stupid. Chances are pretty good the drugs wouldn't kill you. They'd just turn you into a vegetable. I know one nurse at the medical center that happened to. Man, alcohol and diabetes medicine. They're changing her diapers 3 times a day now. Plus, it wouldn't make sense. A guy goes comatose, then dies, then becomes a crispy critter. Okay. That information helpful at all? I probably didn't sound too enthusiastic when I said, yeah, it's helpful. Now, what was that about the Oilers? Lozano started to say, but the phone was already halfway to the cradle. Milo Chavez was even more thrilled to hear from me.
Tell me Miranda's safe, he demanded. Miranda's safe. Tell me I shouldn't kill you for taking off with her like you did.
Come on, Milo. I had a couple of Avalon County dicks in the office this morning, Navarre. They had some questions about how Les and I got along with Brent Daniels, why I might have hired a PI and what kind of work you did, whether you were licensed or not. I didn't like the direction they were going.
Avalon County Homicide couldn't detect its way out of a cascarone, Milo. They're just trying to rattle you. They're succeeding.
I told him about my afternoon, about the autopsy files from Frank, then about the warehouse address I'd visited on Perrin Vital.
I know that place, Milo said. This is good, isn't it? The RIAA guy, Barrera, he'll need to move on it now, right?
You ask Barrera, he'll tell you nothing's changed. There's still no evidence, no probable cause for a search. Just the fact I saw somebody there who I didn't like isn't enough. Barrera's willing to hold out another few years if it means strengthening his legal case.
I've got until Friday, Milo muttered, and you're talking about years.
Barrera's technically correct, I said. There's nothing they can move on in what I've found, at least not right away.
Technically correct, Milo mumbled. That's just great.
We'll figure out something, I promised.
And Les?
That one was harder to sound confident on. Consider him gone, for good. Milo was silent, probably trying to formulate some kind of B plan. When he spoke again, his voice was strange, tightly controlled.
I'll need to talk to Miranda. If we're going to have to come clean with Century when we bring them the tape, I need to talk to my client about strategy. She needs to know the risks.
Maybe I'll bring her by later tonight, I promised. It'll take a couple of hours.
My office at 9, he suggested.
Okay. And Barrera is good, Milo. The people he's working with are good. They will eventually put Sheckley's ass in a sling. The other end of the line was deadly calm. Milo?
I'm fine, he said.
Let it go, Milo.
All right.
Your office at 9. Milo said sure. As he hung up, he was still speaking, muttering unhappy and angry thoughts. I had the feeling I was no longer part of the conversation.
Chapter 53. Mendoza Street ran along the eastern edge of the San Fernando Cemetery. On the left-hand side of the road, the graveyard's chain-link fence tilted and bowed at irregular intervals, like a football team had been using it for blocking practice. Evening ground fog had thickened on the cemetery lawn, diluting the tombstones and the air and the trees into one grayish smear. On the right side of the street was a line of box houses with brightly painted wood slat siding and burglar-barred windows and worn tar shingle roofs. The yards were squares of crabgrass, some gravel, some display areas for broken furniture and tires. There were no kids in sight, nothing of value on the porches, no windows open. Few cars parked on the street except those that had been stolen from other parts of town, then stripped and abandoned here. There were plenty of those. Number 344 was a turquoise one-bedroom in slightly better repair than the houses around it. Ralph's maroon Cadillac and a baby blue Camaro were in the driveway. The front yard was white gravel, decorated with bottle caps. The burglar bars on the screen door and windows were painted white and shaped like ivy, though they were so ornate and thick, they reminded me more of a fused curtain of bones. I rang the bell and stood on the porch for about 20 seconds before Ralph answered the door mid-laugh. Somewhere behind him, I could hear Miranda laughing, too. The smell of Mota smoke wafted out the door. "Hey, vato!" Ralph's glasses shimmered yellow in the porch light. He stood aside to let me in. The living room was bare except for one brown couch opposite the window. The interior walls were stark white and the floors hardwood, and several bullet holes in the ceiling had been imperfectly spackled over. Drive-by souvenirs from the house's previous owner. Ralph had gotten the place cheap because of that. Through an archway, I could see Miranda sitting at a dining table across from another woman. They were both laughing so hard they were wiping away tears. Miranda was still dressed as she had been this morning, in jeans, boots, and my T-shirt. Her face had more color, though. Her posture was a little less weighed down. The other woman was a young Latina with long coppery hair and a bright yellow dress that showed lots of leg. She wore black pumps and silver earrings and makeup. When the women saw me, they both smiled. Miranda said my name like it was a pleasant memory from 20 years ago. The other woman got up and came to give me a hug.
"Hey, vaquero."
She kissed both my ears and stepped back to appraise me.
"Callie," I said, "how you doing?"
"Así, así."
Then, still in Spanish,
"You've got a nice lady here."
I looked at Miranda, who was still smiling and wiping her eyes. There was only one lit joint in the room, in Ralph's hand, but there were assorted munchies on the table, bags of tortilla chips, a steaming canister of Ralph's homemade venison tamales, a plate of Ralph's special pan dulce, the kind with the green flecks in the icing.
Uh-oh.
Ralph saw my expression and spread his hands.
"Everything's cool, vato, just relaxing, doing the grief process, right?"
I stared at him. Ralph shrugged, turned to Callie.
"Hey, mamacita, let's go out back, get Chico to take you home."
Callie said goodbye to Miranda, gave her a hug, then kissed me one last time. Ralph gave us an amused grin, then led his lady friend out the screen door. In the floodlit backyard, Chico, of the yellow pirate bandana and the easily kicked balls, was working on a half-assembled Shelby. Ralph kept the car out there, just for his grunts, sort of like the block table for kids at the doctor's office. Chico stopped messing with the fuel pump and quickly wiped his hands when Callie and Ralph came out. I sat across the table from Miranda and turned the plate of laced pan dulce around. "How many?" Miranda blinked very slowly.
"Two? I don't remember."
"Great." My face was apparently good enough to warrant another laugh. She held her hand over her mouth, quivered slightly for 5 beats, and then did a little snort on beat 6. "I guess I shouldn't ask how you're feeling," I ventured.
"I'm sorry," she said. It feels good to laugh, Trace. Callie's so nice. Ralph is really lucky."
"Sure," I said.
"Have they been together long?"
I hesitated. "Actually, they're more like business partners." Miranda frowned. She reached for another pan dulce before I moved the plate. "Better not," I said.
"Oh, right."
She went for the bag of Doritos instead, examined the plastic edges.
"Ralph and Callie told me not to be mad at you. They talk about you pretty highly. Said you usually knew what you were talking about, even if it wasn't fun to hear."
Outside, Ralph had finished giving Chico his orders. Ralph tossed him a set of car keys, then swatted Callie's behind by way of farewell. She grinned, then followed her yellow bandanaed chauffeur around the side of the house, out of sight. "I spoke to Allison today," I said. Miranda smiled ruefully.
"My best friend in the whole world."
I told her about Allison moving out, about the addresses we had tracked, about how I had some new information on Brent's murder. Miranda tried to pull her expression together to anchor herself on my words. Her attention disintegrated quickly. There was a small hole in the upper corner of the Dorito bag, much too little to get a chip through. The problem was too much for Miranda's stoned sensibilities. Finally, she started breaking up chips inside the bag with one finger, getting them small enough to fit through the hole. My story faltered to a stop. Miranda looked up, probably wondering why the sound of my voice had gone away.
What?
Milo wanted to see you tonight to talk strategy. Maybe I should call him, tell him tomorrow would be better. She processed those words.
Milo wants...
Her voice trailed off, like she was just remembering that name.
My brother is dead, and Allison's leaving town, and Milo wants to talk about Century Records.
A car engine started in the driveway. Seconds later, the headlights of the baby blue Camaro slipped through the living room window, over the couch, and across the living room table, then disappeared down Mendoza Street. Miranda moved a small piece of tortilla chip across the table with her finger, like it was a checker.
We should talk, Trace, before we see Milo.
I know.
The things you said last night, the way you made me out...
The screen door squeaked open and Ralph came in alone. I turned back toward Miranda. Like I said, tomorrow would be better. I'll call Milo.
Pinche Chavez, Ralph put in. This lady need help. It ain't gonna come from his sorry ass.
He looked at Miranda. She rewarded him with a faint smile. I walked to the phone. Ralph sat where I had been sitting and helped himself to the tamales. As he pried off the canister lid, a cloud of steam and cumin and spiced meat smells mushroomed up. He pulled out three of the tamales and began unshucking them. He told Miranda not to worry about a thing. We'd be taking care of her. Gladys answered the phone at the agency office. Milo in? I asked her. Gladys sounded like she was shuffling furniture or maybe moving quickly into another part of the office. Her tone was low and urgent.
He's out, she whispered.
You mean you don't know?
What do you mean, out? Our questions cross-fired and tangled. We both backtracked and waited. Okay, I said. Tell me what happened. Gladys told me how Milo had canceled his dinner meeting with an important client, then stormed out of the office. He'd thrown his pager on Gladys's desk on the way out, telling her, don't bother. He'd said he had some business to take care of. Gladys had been worried enough to check Milo's desk, which she'd been forbidden to do, but which she apparently knew well enough to notice what was missing. The handgun Milo kept in the middle drawer. She had just assumed, me being the most disreputable person Milo knew, no offense, of course, that he'd gone somewhere with me. Gladys was about to tell me something else, something to justify her prying, but I cut her off. How long ago?
10 minutes,
she said, plaintive, apologetic. I hung up and looked at Ralph, then at Miranda.